Central Coast of California has been an integral part of the California wine growing industry since the 1870s. Some of the oldest Zinfandel vines planted in 1880 in Edna Valley are still thriving. And that's the center point and the hook that created a new book called The Mad Crush by Sean Christopher Weir. Tell us the backstory of Sausalito Canyon and the legendary Zinfandel vines circa 1880.
Well, they're vines whose roots run very, very deep on the Central Coast in the upper Arroyo Grande Valley, which is about 16 miles east of the ocean on the edge of the Los Padres National Forest. And back in 1880, an entrepreneur named Henry Ditmas found his way out to the canyon and took a chance and planted a vineyard. It was 3 acres of Zinfandel vines, and he planted an orchard. This is 1880, and it's a remote canyon now, so I imagine it felt very remote 135 years ago. So those vines were planted, they thrived, they produced wine through the early part of the next century, but Prohibition kind of knocked the legs out from underneath the vineyard and the local wine industry, and so those vines went dormant for another, say, 20 or 30 years before they were rediscovered and resurrected.
The guy that rediscovered those vines that were overgrown and probably hardly even recognizable as grapevines was a man that you came to work for here.
Yes, his name was Bill Greeno, and he'd grown up down the coast in the Montecito area of Santa Barbara. And he had his own unique journey in how he came to love and make wine in a neighborhood called Mountain Drive in Santa Barbara. Very colorful place, very legendary now as sort of what they call Santa Barbara's original bohemian community. And up there they made communal wine, and that's where Bill came to love the craft of wine and the art of growing grapes. And so he went looking for his own place to embark on his own journey of wine.
This was way ahead of the curve of the modern incarnation of wine growing on the Central Coast. This was in the early 70s, right?
The Mountain Drive winemaking was actually in the 60s and dated back to even the 50s. And you're right, it predated what you would consider commercial winemaking here on the Central Coast.
In the incarnation that you became involved in, Sausalito Canyon with Bill Greeno, you arrived when?
I found my way out to the canyon in 1992 while I was a student at Cal Poly, the nearby university. So I became a cellar rat as sort of a part-time job to help me get through school. So you have these sort of three arcs of the story. You have Henry planting the vines in 1880. You have Bill coming out of the mountains of Santa Barbara and resurrecting those vines with nothing more than a pick and shovel in 1974. And then fast forward in 1991 or 92, I had the privilege of finding my own way out there and becoming a part of the history and the story of this canyon and its vines.
Your book, The Mad Crush, a memoir of mythic vines and improbable winemaking, is engaging and fascinating. I think you did a masterful job of storytelling. I hear your voice. I hear you when I read the words. Tell us some of the highlights, the most memorable things that you captured.
Well, writing the book was initially kind of challenging because I had these sort of three eras and these three stories and these three people, including myself, whose stories I was trying to tell. And to knit those together into a narrative that wasn't necessarily chronological but was more thematic. And how do I do that? And so it kind of comes in and out of history through all the way to the present day. In the end, I think you get a sense of why these vines were planted, why someone would come out there with a pick and shovel and restore them, and why others like myself would also go out and become part of the story of these grapes and these vines that continues today.
There are so many dimensions to your story. There's environmental factors, weather and heat and the threat of range fires. And then the other dimension that I still laugh about it are the personalities that you worked with, and like the guy on the forklift that was Evel Knievel on the loose.
I returned back to the canyon in 95, and that's really the sort of where the action of the story revolves around. And Bill Greeno, our boss, never really mounted much of a recruitment effort. It was people like me who answered the call on a job board. So we ended up with this rather motley crew, a little crazy, a little fast and loose on the forklift, and there were other sort of follies and adventures that befell us during that season. That's really something I wanted to capture, was sort of the sense, you know, there's so much about wine, about the romance of wine, and I think too often it's about the gloss. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wanted to peel back or open the door to the grit and what it really takes to make wine, and the personalities and the people and the hard work and the bare knuckle grind, what is really an agricultural pursuit.
I don't think there's any finer way to learn about what a book is really about than to have the author read a little section.
Sure. Here's an excerpt from the book describing Bill's visit and eventual homesteading himself of the canyon.
And this is Bill Greeno, the owner.
His friend Michael Benedict was a proponent of cool climate wine growing, and he was in Bill's ear, evangelizing about the virtues of the transverse coastal valleys that opened up to the Pacific Ocean in Santa Barbara County and southern San Luis Obispo County. Whereas most California valleys paralleled the coastline, the transverse valleys, a quirk of geologic evolution, ran west to east. In these valleys, the marine air met no resistance as it billowed inland. They were like funnels, sucking in the cool breath of the Pacific. One day, Bill's realtor called. There was a property for sale in the upper Arroyo Grande Valley in southern San Luis Obispo County. The property was the old Rancho Sausalito. The granddaughters of Henry Ditmas, the original homesteader, had recently put it up for sale. It didn't sound that great to Bill, but he figured it couldn't hurt to look. After all, the Arroyo Grande Valley was one of those rare transverse valleys that his friend Michael Benedict was always talking about. So then he goes and drives out to the property, and it continues. Finally, they reached the gate and drove into the heart of the property. Bill stepped out of the car. The first thing he noticed was the smell, a dusty, dry herb aroma blowing off the chaparral. Before him was an expanse of scrub and poison oak riddled with the overgrown knobs of what looked like dead vines. To the left, a tall mesa loomed like the Great Wall. To the right and behind, the wilderness ascended, cradling the old rancho. And straight ahead was the breathtaking edifice of High Mountain. A cool breeze rattled through the oak trees, but that was not what sent the shiver up Bill's spine. It was something else, a sudden sense of feeling at home in this strange, rugged land.
Would you mind sharing a section from the process inside of the winery? You do such a masterful job of atmospheric painting a picture of location, but there's also that dimension of that freneticness of the harvest that you also deftly capture.
At Sausalito Canyon, fermentation took place in two types of vessels: plastic 4x4-foot bins that could be moved around with a pallet jack, and a fixed open-top 3,000-gallon stainless steel tank behind the winery building. During fermentation, the grape skins float to the top of the mass, forming a cap that will dry out if left unattended. To foster the desired skin contact, you need to make sure that the skins stay moist and mixed with the juice during fermentation. This is where punchdowns and pumpovers come into play. To perform punchdowns, we stood on the edge of one of the plastic bins, wielding a wooden paddle and punching it through the thick cap of skins. We worked our way around the entire bin, mashing away. By the end, the hard cap had been turned into a supple, wet stew. Each bin was punched down 2 to 3 times per day. Sore legs and arms were inevitable after a day of punchdowns. The stainless steel tank out back was too large for punchdowns. In this larger vessel, the new cap was just too hard and thick for a person to mash, hence the pumpover. With the pumpover, we pumped juice from a valve at the bottom of the tank and out through the hose at the top of the tank to moisten and mix the skins. Typically, pumpovers are done from some fixed position by securing the hose to a sprinkler at the top of the tank, or at least aiming it from the security of an adjoining catwalk. But not at Sausalito Canyon. To perform pumpovers on the large tank, we would climb up on the retaining wall, then scramble onto a loose board straddled atop the tank. We would do our pumpovers while balancing on this board directly over the wide mouth of grape skins below, the hose bucking in our hands like an angry snake as the juice splashed out of the end. Abundant carbon dioxide gas is created during fermentation. And with this larger tank, the gas and alcohol fumes can be pretty potent. So while we were balancing on the board and steadying the bucking hose with both hands, we were also trying to make sure we weren't getting too lightheaded from oxygen deprivation.
As you're reading your story, you're painting a picture in my mind of the California Central Coast, coastal, very, very distinctive and totally predicated on the maritime influences that allow growers to grow one varietal, do a great job, Chardonnay, and others, no. Tell us about some of the defining characteristics of that coastal region.
Yeah, this coastal region of southern San Luis Obispo County is what I would call uber coastal. The word coastal has been slightly abused by the wine industry and could mean anything from the shoreline to 50 miles in. But here, on average, you're looking at maybe 5 miles from the ocean for the vineyards. And
I know in your mind there are very distinctive parameters that define the beginning and end of that maritime-influenced coastal environment. Before we go on, a little backstory on that.
So when you are this close to the ocean, you're getting a maritime effect that is very, very pronounced with these prevailing marine breezes. And also the soils are very marine in origin, very mixed, very young. And so that brings a lot of complexity to the wines that are grown here. And that maritime influence on the climate means that you can only grow certain varieties very well. And we call those cool climate varieties. You're looking at Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, aromatic whites like Albarino. In these climates, it's a little more difficult to grow what you would consider maybe a warmer weather variety, such as Cabernet Sauvignon. The Zinfandel in Sausalito Canyon sort of splits the difference because it's a little inland, it's a little warmer. But because Zinfandel is often associated with warm climates, you're getting this unique cool climate expression of Zinfandel, which I think makes it very unique.
Fog plays a real critical factor, doesn't it? Allowing you to have cool nights.
Absolutely. We would be out in the afternoon and on certain harvest days reaching 90 degrees and sweating our asses off. And by 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, the fog, the marine air starts to billow inland, and it's this reliable swing of temperatures on sort of a daily or diurnal basis that not only make our lives more pleasant being here, but also the grapes really respond to that because they get that cooling effect every night, which elongates the ripening process.
In your book, I remember you talking about some of the mysteries of the grapes in that ripening process or not.
Yeah, you know, wine is kind of a living thing, and during the season I was out there, the grapes were not responding. They were not ripening like they should based on the weather patterns. But you come to understand that there's a larger sort of force at work and that Mother Nature's in control, and there's sort of this holistic relationship between you and the vines and nature and the climate. And for some things, there was just no explanation. We just had to be patient and have faith that they were going to come along. And I almost believe at some level that that faith is what really brings it all along. You kind of have to believe, and that's the challenge, but that's also the beauty of making something soulful like wine.
And as I recall, that was one of the characteristics of Bill Greeno and his approach. It was very much intuited rather than by the numbers.
Exactly. And I'd done a crush at a larger winery, much more textbook winemaking, so I knew that side of the wine business. And the canyon was sort of the antithesis of that. And because it was remote, because it was small, because he didn't have a lot of resources, he adapted his own techniques and his own equipment and bent them around what the vineyard was giving him. And he was not a textbook or a really even professionally trained winemaker or wine grower, but he knew every nook and cranny. He knew what the grapes wanted. And that was a revelation to me. And that's when I started to understand wine as yeah, there's a science to it, but there's also a soulfulness and a sort of meditative aspect to wine, and there's different ways to make it. And I think wine ultimately does have a soul, if you look at it that way.
Fascinating reading your story, your journey. There are many, many days where it's kind of relaxing, slow-paced, and then all of a sudden harvest comes and crush comes, and it's frenetic and insane. Tell us about that dynamic, and maybe there's an excerpt that you could read us from your book about that.
Sure, here we go. The first day of the crush ended quietly. The picking was done by early afternoon, and by late afternoon we had processed all of the fruit and cleaned off the equipment. The yellow jackets retreated as we washed the last of the sticky grape residue down the cellar drain. We joked around and still felt fresh. The crush was off to a good start. Many harvest days ahead would begin like this one, but they would become progressively more complicated as the weeks wore on. As fermentation space became tight, the small cellar would begin to resemble a chess match, with Bill figuring out where to make his next move. As the different wine lots finished fermentation, we would have to rack them to new wine barrels. We would also have to shovel the skins out of the tanks and press them to liberate the remaining wine. As these additional tasks were layered into our workflow, the days would start looping around in multiple directions, often concluding long after sundown. For now, we would take as many linear days as we could get.
When I picked up your book, The Mad Crush, I thought it was going to be all about wine and wine-centric and kind of a little bit of the snotty ego aspect of the wine industry. But my takeaway is that it really isn't a wine book. Even though wine is the metaphor, the little thematic thread that takes you through the book, it's a sociological, it's a historical piece, it's a moment in time, it's a life story of the Central Coast.
Yeah, exactly, Tom. And for me, really, the wine aspect of the book, my time in the canyon making wine, was really, for this book, an excuse to tell what I think is a larger and more important story. It's really, I think, a book about entrepreneurship, about mentorship, about history, and this idea that someone would find their way out to this canyon and to take on the monumental task of planting these vines in 1880, and all of the dominoes that have fallen forward since then, and how that act and how those vines have changed my life, how they changed Bill's life, how they changed Bill's son Tom's life. He's making wine out there in the canyon, and I know many, many other people who passed through that canyon and either became winemakers or somehow the trajectory of their life was changed by that experience, as was mine. And so that's what this book is really about. It's about understanding where you came from and paying respect to those who came before you and finding a way to pay that forward. And so I think it's really a story that comes full circle on the Central Coast, but also personally for me.
Where would somebody find your book? How would they get it?
The easiest place is to go to themadcrush.com, and there you will find links to purchase the book in digital or paperback format from retailers such as Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
We've been speaking with Sean Christopher Weir, the author of The Mad Crush, a memoir of mythic vines and improbable winemaking.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show, Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a weekly featured podcast on NPR.org, produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. Our San Francisco-based associate producer is Molly Blaisdell, covering the San Francisco Bay Area, the island of Maui, and the South Pacific. Our Wisconsin-based associate producer is Julie Henning.